Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 55. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 1010 at the Radisson Riverside Hotel in Rochester, New York. In this episode, snakes on a plane, again, more Dreamliner woes, lithium-ion batteries, very important safety alert issued from the FAA, your feedback, and more. So, get all settled in. Tray tables and seat backs in their upright and locked positions, electronic devices powered on, Flight 55 is ready for pushback. Greetings and salutations. Welcome aboard Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 55. If you're listening for the first time, let me introduce myself. My name is Captain Jeff. And I'm an active line pilot flying for a major legacy airline headquartered in the United States of America. And referring to my air carrier, I use a fictitious name, Acme Air, as I am not an official spokesperson for my real airline, and I never want anybody to be confused about that. So let's see, on the show, what do? We talk about some of the news in the aviation world, give you my commentary on it. Occasionally, I'll discuss accidents and incidents and dissect them and analyze them and give my expert opinion about them. But the bulk of the show centers on you, my listeners, and your questions about flying, life as an airline pilot, and more. So let's start by looking at what's happening in the news. Sounds so official, doesn't it? Okay, well, you know, the 787 is in the news almost constantly lately. And the FAA has announced, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and the FAA Chief Michael Huerta and the Boeing Commercial Airlines or Airplanes Chief Executive Ray Conner all got together and announced that they're going to launch an extensive review or a holistic review of the program that will put the twin jet under an unprecedented level of scrutiny barely 15 months after entering service. And the review will seek to determine the root causes of the safety and technical incidents plaguing some 787 flights, with a special focus on the aircraft's 1.5 megawatt capacity electrical system. But federal officials are also being careful to paint the effort as a precautionary measure, lest the traveling public start thinking of the 787 as a safety hazard. Huerta says, "We believe the 787 is a safe aircraft." And there was another quote I was going to quote from. And let me see if I can find that, because I thought that was kind of telling. Let's see here. I'm vamping a little bit. Okay, I'm looking for the 787 tag. And, this is one I thought was kind of telltale. You know, the FAA has the responsibility for both ensuring the safety of our air travel system, but it also, in a smaller way, actually is there to promote our aviation system in our country. So here's Huerta's quote. He acknowledged the importance of the 787 to Boeing and the U.S. economy and said that that's why we care about maintaining public confidence that it is safe. So, you know, we want to make sure, you know, Boeing employs a lot of people here, and this is a big program that they set off on, and they want to make sure that nobody gets the wrong idea here, that this thing is not unsafe, but they do want to figure out what's going on, you know. And when they were considering launching this investigation or this thorough research on what's happening here, they said they basically had three different things they could do. One would be to do nothing, which they said would leave a festering doubt in the public mind, with some people remaining unconvinced by Boeing's assurances. The other option would be a drastic grounding of the fleet, which would do immense harm to Boeing. So the third option was the best in their mind to do this investigation. So we'll see what happens with that. And in a related matter, the lithium ion. Before I talk about lithium ion batteries, is it lithium? Yeah, I keep mispronouncing that. Lithium based batteries. But before I do, just wanted to mention that Japan Airlines 787 that was leaking the fuel at Boston's Logan International last week, I believe. The same airplane, the same exact airplane, somewhere over in Japan had that same thing happen. And this time they believe it actually leaked a little bit more fuel. And apparently it has something to do with the fuel valve in one of the tanks, like the center tank, actually opening when it shouldn't and supplying fuel under positive pressure to one of the wing tanks. And of course, the wing tank is already full, so the fuel has nowhere to go but out the vent. So that's what happened at Boston, and this is also what happened at the Japanese airport. So that airplane, that particular one, is grounded once again. Okay, so let me go back to the lithium ion battery thing. Oh, before I do, one more thing I want to say. The review that the FAA is going to start on the 787 is mostly going to center on the electrical system of the Boeing, and in particular, an electrical panel that was manufactured in Mexico. And apparently that seems to be one of the common denominators with a lot of these electrical problems. So they're going to do a very extensive review on the company that manufactured that part and take a close look at that electrical panel to see what's going on with that. Okay, so now we're going to talk about lithium ion batteries. The fire on the Boeing 787 at Boston's Logan was due to a battery, a lithium ion battery, that was responsible for starting up the auxiliary power unit. And the thing about lithium ion batteries is that they're very powerful. And let me start from the beginning of this article. The power sources for devices ranging from Apple's iPad to power tools to plug-in cars, you know, the Volt and other electric cars, they hold so much energy and are so flammable that when they ignite, they can be difficult to extinguish as they spew flames and even molten metal, according to U.S. government tests. Boeing got U.S. regulators permission to install the lithium ion batteries on the Dreamliner in 2007, 3 years after passenger airlines were barred from carrying non-rechargeable types as cargo. And Michael Barr, he was one of my instructors at the University of Southern California's Aviation Safety and Security Program that I took while I was in the Air Force back in the 80s. He is quoted as saying, "We know that batteries burn, and we know that lithium batteries have a higher propensity to burn. Is there a basic design issue?" And so he said that this week's fire in Boston probably will also, or the review of the fire in Boston will also examine whether the 2007 decision provided adequate safety. Boeing on their part, said that they've installed multiple circuits to ensure that the plane's power system won't overcharge the batteries, which can cause them to heat up and burn. So they put a lot of system protections, they believe. Again, that's going to be something they're going to review to make sure that they're working as they're supposed to. The Dreamliner is the first Boeing airplane designed with lithium-ion batteries as part of the electrical system. Boeing chose them for the 787, which uses more electricity than previous aircraft designs because they hold more energy and can be quickly recharged. In a worst-case scenario in which the batteries do burn, they are designed to do so in a way that doesn't threaten the aircraft, according to, who is this? He's one of the lead engineers on the Boeing. And he said that if the jet is airborne, smoke is vented out of the compartment and won't reach the cabin. All of the battery cells can ignite without harming the plane's ability to stay aloft. The damage from the January 7th fire was confined to within 20 inches of the battery pack, according to the NTSB. A photo released by the agency appeared to show that nearby electrical equipment was untouched. The base where the battery sat was charred. And I also read in another report that flames were shooting about 2 feet high. I don't know about you, but that doesn't make me feel really, really comfortable or that much better about these lithium-ion batteries in airplanes. But if they can ensure that they're safe, then I guess they're okay. So, well, I'm going to go ahead and pause momentarily because I believe my crew is getting together to eat some barbecue here in Rochester. Yeah, if you're familiar with Rochester, New York, or Syracuse for that matter, you'll probably have heard of the restaurant Dinosaurs Barbecue, and they have a really good barbecue, astonishingly good barbecue for this far north. And so I'm going to meet with the rest of the crew downstairs in the lobby, and when I come back, I'll continue our show. So stay tuned. Well, hey, just so that you know that I wasn't lying, we are at Dinosaurs Barbecue, and the whole crew, this is kind of unusual. Usually, one person or two people or whatever kind of bow out, but this is one of those unusual cases where the whole crew gets together and we're acting like we're having a good time here at Dinosaurs Barbecue in Rochester, New York. So say hi to everybody, to my listeners.
Hi,
hello.
Listeners.
Hello, good evening.
Having a great time. I'm not just pretending.
I think now you're really making it sound like you're pretending.
Cheers.
Cheers, that's
Cheers.
Right. Here.
Prost. So,
okay. Thanks. Okay, I'm back. And we had a great meal at Dinosaurs here in Rochester and just arrived back in my room. It's cold outside. Just yesterday here in Rochester, I think the high was in the upper 60s. And right now, I can tell you right now with a wind chill, it's probably in the 20s. Very, very chilly, especially if you're an idiot like me that doesn't have a coat. Okay, so let's move on with the last piece of news that I had. And this was pointed out to me from a couple of you listeners, Kevin St. John and John in Minnesota. And this is a special or safety alert for operators issued by the FAA on the 4th of January, 2013. And the title of this is Manual Flight Operations. Purpose, this special, this safety alert for operators encourages operators to promote manual flight operations when appropriate. Background, a recent analysis of flight operations data, including normal flight operations, incidents, and accidents, identified an increase in manual handling errors. The Federal Aviation Administration believes maintaining and improving the knowledge and skills for manual flight operations is necessary for safe flight operations. Modern aircraft are commonly operated using autoflight systems, for example, autopilot or autothrottle, autothrust. Unfortunately, continuous use of those systems does not reinforce a pilot's knowledge and skills in manual flight operations. Autoflight systems are useful tools for pilots and have improved safety and workload management, and thus enabled more precise operations. However, continuous use of autoflight systems could lead to degradation of the pilot's ability to quickly recover the aircraft from an undesired state. Operators are encouraged to take an integrated approach by incorporating emphasis of manual flight operations into both line operations and training, initial, upgrade, and recurrent. Operational policies should be developed or reviewed to ensure there are appropriate opportunities for pilots to exercise manual flying skills, such as in a non-RVSM airspace and during low workload conditions. In addition, policies should be developed or reviewed to ensure that pilots understand when to use the automated systems, such as during high workload conditions or airspace procedures that require use of autopilot for precise operations. Augmented crew operations may also limit the ability of some pilots to obtain practice in manual flight operations. Airline operational policies should ensure that all pilots have the appropriate opportunities to exercise the aforementioned knowledge and skills in flight operations. So the recommended action for this safety alert: directors of operations, program managers, directors of training, training center managers, chief pilots, check pilots, training pilots, and flight crews should be familiar with the content of this safety alert. They should work together to ensure that the content of this SAFO is incorporated into operational policy provided to pilots during ground training and reinforced in flight training and proficiency checks. So hopefully the major operators out there will take heed of this safety alert for operators and start incorporating it into training, and also incorporating it into its emphasis items. And so the line check airmen out there should be actively promoting the use of manual flying when appropriate. Just common sense. And something that I'm very pleased to see, because this is something that I've been preaching about for quite some time. So it's good to see that this is happening. So thank you, Kevin and John, for forwarding that to me. And John also writes, this must have been a... You know what? I need to play my feedback thing, stinger.
Captain, incoming message.
Thank you. So, there we go. Continuing with John's feedback. He says, and this must have been quite the interesting diversion for the passengers and crew. And this was a Acme 777 over the Atlantic on January 9th, and they had some problems with one of their engines. They only have two. And apparently there was some kind of a oil leak or something, some kind of a something they were concerned about, and they decided that they should divert to their ETOPS alternate, in this case, Ascension Island. And so they diverted there, and they dumped fuel, of course, first to lighten the weight of the aircraft, and then they diverted to a British Air Force base on Ascension Island. And so they safely diverted, and they ended up getting, I think, a 747 was flown with a replacement engine, but in the meantime, they flew a replacement 777 to come and pick up the passengers, and I believe they got home, about 20 hours past the original time they were supposed to arrive home in Atlanta. But everybody was safe and sound, and apparently the British at the Air Force Base on Ascension Island did a good job of taking care of them. So, a happy ending. And John says, that reminds me of a business trip I did to Vernon, Texas last year. the little town in North Texas that you mentioned in one of your previous podcasts, which has the Girls in Flight Training Program, the GIFT program. I flew into the Wichita Falls, Texas airport, which is co-located with Shepherd Air Force Base. It was quite fun to see all the Air Force training aircraft as we were landing and taxiing out. So the base that this ACME flight diverted was one of those joint-use facilities, a military/civilian facility. So thanks, John, in Minneapolis for sending that feedback. And let us continue with some more feedback. Now, in the last episode, we were talking about the L-1011 at one of our bases, and I got this from Aaron. He was just listening to the last episode and heard your feedback regarding the L-1011 and the Foreign Object Damage Walk, the FOD walk. I am a ramper for ACME Global Services. A company policy dictates that before every arrival, the marshaller is to perform a FOD walk of the arrival ramp area. Most of the time, everyone keeps an eye out and pick up any FOD noticed. Thanks for the podcast. You're welcome. Thanks, Aaron, for your feedback. And again, if you're unfamiliar with the term FOD, that's foreign object damage, or foreign objects, I guess. It's one of those things where, you know, we call it FOD damage, but that's kind of, it's just redundant in a way, because it's really FO damage, or we just call it FOD. But that's going out there making sure there aren't little pieces of things that might be ingested by the engines and cause damage to the engines. And so apparently that is company policy at ACME to make sure that the ramp is clear and free of anything that might cause damage to the airplane. So thank you, Aaron, again for sending the feedback. And let's see, I have some audio feedback from Miss Lynn. Let's listen to what she has to say.
Hello, Jeff. This is Lynn from Durham, North Carolina. I have a question for you that I'd actually been meaning to ask you since my travel to and from Maui last September. It might even be one that perhaps a flight attendant friend Marcia can answer. But here's the question anyway. I was on Hawaiian Airlines, leaving from San Diego to Honolulu. And I remember that before the plane took off, we were asked to raise the window shades for takeoff, and that after the plane was safely up in the air, we could lower them again if we wished. I don't recall ever having been asked to do such a thing on other domestic flights, although I do recall that on some other international flights, particularly when I was traveling to Asia. And I think I also remembered this request being made when I traveled on Emirates as well towards the Middle East, that we were asked to raise the window shades for during takeoff and landing. I was wondering what the reasons would be for this request. Any insights? Any from you and from Marcia would be very welcomed. Thanks a lot, Jeff. And how does the expression go? Clear skies, tailwinds, and, well, you know the drill. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Lynn, for your feedback. And this would be a great question for Marcia or even Kevin McGrady, my Catholic cabin crew member that I met with last week, and I mentioned on the last episode, but I'm going to ask it without using them as my resource. Most domestic U.S. carriers do not require window shades up unless you are having a planned emergency landing. There are one or two that do require window shades to be up during all takeoffs and landings. And by the way, tonight we were talking about this because the crew that I was with was asking about my podcast and what it was about, and what kinds of things do people ask about? And I mentioned the window shade thing. My first officer, Talmadge, said that an airline, or maybe a couple of airlines that he's flown for, Pinnacle being one of them, actually does do this. They require that the window shades are up for takeoffs and landings, according to him, unless I misunderstood him. But going back to my answer here, the reasoning is that you need to be able to rapidly and clearly assess the conditions outside during an evacuation. They do, however, need to be up for every takeoff and landing on emergency exit windows. Seatbacks, okay, so the shades, that's the reason for that. So if you're in a abort situation or a crash, God forbid, it's important to be able to have the windows up or the window shades up so you can see whether the airplane is upside down or if it's right side up, if there is a fire outside. And then you go, okay, there's a fire through those windows that I see. Let's evacuate on the other side. And the other point that I read about was that in a lot of airplanes, the flight attendants who are responsible for your safety during an evacuation are in seats that don't really have really, really good views of what's going on outside the aircraft. And they kind of rely on the passengers and their reactions to things. And so if they notice that there's some kind of a commotion in the passenger cabin because the windows are open and people are looking outside and they see something that is of concern, this is something that alerts the flight attendants. So it's, again, a safety issue. You might wonder why we ask you to have your seat backs in their up and locked position. A couple of reasons. The person behind you may need to get out in a hurry if you have to evacuate, and every inch of space helps. You don't want to block their egress. And the seat design, in an impact, the upright locked seat has the most structural integrity. And the third reason is an impact or sudden stop, perhaps in an aborted takeoff or nearing decision speed, you are less likely to suffer whiplash or neck injury if the seatbacks are on their up and locked, their upright position. And then we kind of covered this on an earlier podcast about dimming the lights that, you know, as Marcia said, the reason why we do that is so that everybody's eyes can acclimate to the ambient lighting so that when you lose all of your lighting and electricity, you know, you're not like walking out of that movie theater into the broad daylight and you can't see anything. So if you can, you know, be ready, if your retinas or your pupils are already set to the ambient lighting, then you have a better chance of figuring out what where to go and what you're looking at in an emergency situation. So thank you, Lynn. I hope that answered your question about window shades. And oh, the final answer about window shades is that the reason why we have to have them up for takeoff and landing and pretty much throughout the whole flight is that there might be a deadheading pilot or a non-revving pilot like Captain Jeff who has to see outside. That's really the reason. And this is from Tom. Hi, Captain Jeff. I thoroughly enjoy your podcast. Thank you for your answer to my previous question about speed limits on taxiways. I was listening to one of your recent podcasts about inebriated passengers causing disruptions on flights. One incident involved a Qantas 747 at an early stage of the flight where the pilot declared an emergency, dumped about 16,000 gallons of fuel, and diverted to another airport. That must be close to $50,000 worth of fuel that was discarded. What are some of the other costs, aside from having to refuel the aircraft associated with diverting a flight? Do the airlines attempt to recover any of these costs from the idiot passengers involved in these incidents? So some of the other costs are the costs for the crew. So usually when you encounter a situation as this one, the Qantas 747 that diverted, you're probably going to have to call in another crew. And so you're basically doubling your cost for the hourly rates for all the crew members. Hotel costs for the crew and for passengers. That's a big expense. So there are all kinds of, extra costs associated besides the fuel costs. And then he says a couple of other unrelated questions. Are there rules about when and where fuel can be dumped? Do all commercial flights or aircraft have the ability to dump fuel, or can only the larger long-range planes do it? During a normal flight, as the fuel is used, is there an automatic system for shifting the fuel from tank to tank to keep the load evenly distributed, or do the pilots have to monitor this? Thanks in advance for your response. Tom in St. Charles, Illinois, about 30 miles west of Chicago O'Hare. So fuel dumping. Now, we've talked about this before in previous podcasts, but it doesn't hurt to kind of revisit fuel dumping. Aircraft have two major types of weight limits, the maximum takeoff weight and the maximum structural landing weight, with the maximum structural landing weight almost always being the lower of the two. This allows an aircraft on a normal routine flight to take off at the higher weight, consume fuel en route, and arrive at a lower weight. There are other variables involving takeoff and landing weights, but they are omitted from this article. So this is something I was reading from Wikipedia. It's the abnormal non-routine flight where landing weight can be an issue. If a flight takes off at the maximum takeoff weight and then faces a situation where it must return to the departure airport due to a mechanical problem or a passenger medical issue, there will not be time to consume the fuel meant for getting to the original destination, and the aircraft may exceed the maximum landing weight to land at the departure airport. If an aircraft lands at more than its maximum allowable weight, the plane could potentially break apart on landing, or at the least suffer structural damage. So, going back to the 50s and 60s, the FAA had a rule in effect at the time that mandated that if the ratio between an aircraft's maximum structural weight and its maximum structural landing weight, maximum structural takeoff weight and maximum structural landing weight was greater than 105%, the aircraft had to have a fuel dump system installed. So, aircraft such as the Boeing 707, 727, the Douglas DC-8 had fuel dump systems. Any of those aircraft needing to return to a takeoff airport above the maximum landing weight would jettison an amount of fuel sufficient to reduce the aircraft's weight below that maximum landing weight limit, and then they could land. During the 60s, Boeing introduced the 737 and the Douglas, and Douglas introduced the DC-9, the original models of each being for shorter routes, so the 105% figure was not an issue. Thus, they were built with no fuel dumping systems installed. During the 60s and 70s, both Boeing and Douglas grew their respective aircraft as far as operational capabilities were concerned via Pratt & Whitney's development of increasingly powerful variants of the JT8D engines that powered both aircraft series. Both aircraft were now capable of longer duration flights with increased weight limits, and complying with the existing 105% rule became a problem due to the costs associated with adding a fuel dump system to an aircraft already in production. And considering the more powerful engines that had been developed, the FAA changed the rules to delete the 105% requirement. And Federal Aviation Regulation 25.1001 was enacted, stating a jettison system was not required if the climb requirements of FAR 25.119, landing climb, and FAR 25.121, approach climb, could be met, assuming a 15-minute flight. In other words, for a go-around with full landing flaps and all engines operating, and at approach flap setting and one engine inoperative, respectively. So, in other words, if you could prove that your performance was sufficient to operate in these regimes, then fuel dumping was not a requirement or a fuel dumping system. Since most twin jet airliners can meet these requirements, most aircraft of this type, such as the Boeing 737, all the models of the 737, the DC-9, the MD-80 series, MD-90 series, Boeing 717, and the Airbus A320 family, and various regional jet, RJ aircraft, do not have fuel dump systems installed. In the event of an emergency requiring a return to the departure airport, these airplanes will have to circle or hold and burn fuel in order to consume the fuel necessary to get down to within the maximum structural landing weight limit. Or, if the situation is urgent, we can land the airplane over the maximum structural landing weight and then, you know, let the maintenance folks know and write it up in the logbook, and then they do an overweight landing inspection. So many movies and TV series or TV news stories mistakenly assume that all aircraft can dump fuel when, in fact, most cannot. In certain atmospheric conditions where the moisture content of the air is high, 737s and other aircraft flying at low altitude sometimes leave a moisture trail that can come off of the top of the wing, wingtips or trailing edge flaps. And we've talked about this before, that we had a couple people call or write in with feedback asking about that. And these moisture trails coming off the trailing edge flaps can kind of look like fuel coming out or vaporizing, but that has more to do with aerodynamic forces and disturbance of the air and vapor caused. So it's not a fuel leak or fuel dumping. Longer range twin jets, such as the Boeing 767 and the Airbus A300, 310, 330, may or may not have fuel dump systems, depending on how the aircraft was ordered, since on some aircraft they are a customer option. 3 and 4 engine jets like the Lockheed L-1011, the McDonnell Douglas DC-10, the MD-11, Boeing 747, and Airbus 340 usually have difficulty meeting the requirements of FAR 25-119 near in the maximum structural takeoff weight. So most of these have jettison systems. A Boeing 757 has no fuel dump capability, as its maximum landing weight is similar to the maximum takeoff weight. So when fuel dumping procedures have to take place, they're coordinated with the air traffic control, and precautions are taken to keep other aircraft clear of such areas. And because fuel dumping is usually accomplished at a high enough altitude, the fuel will dissipate before reaching the ground. And an interesting note in this article, the largest scale fuel dumping occurred on September 11th, 2001, when many international flights were refused American airspace entry due to numerous hijacking incidents. Many of these international flights were fueled for travel well into the American interior, and many such flights were diverted into Canadian airspace, Newfoundland specifically, or instructed to return to their point of origin. For those mid-flight aircraft unable to land safely due to excessive fuel weight, fuel dumping became necessary. And so that's a little thing about fuel dumping. And you also asked about, is there an ability to move fuel within the various fuel tanks of an aircraft? And I'd say the general answer to that is, in most cases, no. You can kind of select which engine is burning fuel out of a particular fuel tank, but you can't, in flight, move fuel between tanks. However, there are exceptions to that. The Concorde, the supersonic jet, like most airliners, had multiple tanks. Very, very many tanks. The only difference is that during flight, fuel was transferred from tank to tank to maintain trim and balance of the aircraft, as the Concorde did not have a full tailplane, which would be used on a subsonic airliner to perform this task. So if you look at a picture of the Concorde, you'll notice that it did have a vertical, had a tail and it had a vertical stabilizer, but it did not have a horizontal stabilizer, an elevator system. That was all part of the that big giant wing that it had. And so to kind of keep the airplane trimmed and the center of gravity and the center of lift all balanced, they had the ability to automatically transfer fuel between tanks to keep it trimmed up. And the fuel was also used as a heat sink for cooling purposes. Surplus heat from the air conditioning and hydraulic systems, from the constant speed drive and generator, and also from the engine lubricating oil, was injected through the heat exchangers to the fuel. Now, there are some airplanes that actually do have an active system that transfers fuel between what is sometimes called a stabilizer tank or a stab tank, such as the Airbus 330 and 340 series. They can use the stab tank to actively trim the aircraft during flight. And the 747-400 model also has a stab tank, trim tank system. And I think that's kind of an automatic thing. I'm not sure if I understand exactly how the 747-400 system works, but there are airplanes out there, and I do remember at Acme we operated the MD-11 for many years, and that had a fuel tank back in the tail that fuel was transferred from the main tanks, the center and wing tanks, to the tail to keep the airplane in trim during cruise flight. And so there are cases or exceptions where fuel is moved between tanks, but for specific purposes. So I hope that answers your question about, you know, moving fuel around and such. Let's see. So I'm not sure if I actually asked your question, but you asked about are there rules about when and where fuel can be dumped? And I guess basically, yes. You know, we're usually under air traffic control, and they indicate where we can go out, and it's usually at a certain altitude or above a certain altitude, usually away from populated areas or over water, that kind of thing. And then you ask, do all commercial aircraft have the ability to dump fuel? And I think I answered that. During a normal flight, as the fuel is used, is there an automatic system for shifting the fuel from tank to tank? And I think I answered that. So now on the airplane that I fly, the MD-80 series, MD-90 series, and it's very much like most aircraft out there, we have basically a left wing tank, a right wing tank, and a center tank. And initially, unless we have a situation where the heater blankets on the wings are not working, all the fuel is burned from the center tank first. And then once the center tank fuel is gone, then the fuel tanks in the wings take over, and they feed the corresponding engine. So the left wing tank will feed the left engine. The right wing tank will feed the right engine. It is possible for us to cross-feed. So if the fuel being burned or the fuel in each of the wing tanks is imbalanced for some reason, then it's possible for us to open up a cross-feed valve, turn off boost pumps, and burn fuel like both engines from the left tank or both engines from the right tank. But there is no way in my airplane to actually move fuel from one tank to another, at least in flight. On the ground, there is a defueling valve that can accomplish that kind of thing, but not in flight. We have no control over that. So hope that answers your question, Tom. If you need clarification about anything, just go ahead and follow it up with another question. Okay, I talked about in the preview for this episode, snakes on a plane. And I received several pieces of feedback from you, my listeners, regarding this incident from Australia to Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. And like this one, for instance. Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Peter from the Blue Mountains in Australia. I've never heard of the Blue Mountains. Where are the Blue Mountains, Peter? You'll have to let me know. That sounds like a pretty area. I've been listening for the past 4 or 5 months after coming across you by accident. Today, I'm writing you for two reasons. First, to thank you for making my long work road trips around my local state, which is much larger than Texas, far more enjoyable and educational. So far, I'm up to episode 41, but I've also started listening in real time since before Christmas with Stitcher, and I agree it is far less data hungry and very fast. And I know that for those of you in Australia, that the bandwidth caps there are much more restrictive than at least in the United States. So continuing, I also listen occasionally while I'm riding the snapper around the yard, too. Figure I might as well learn something while I'm sitting on my backside for hours on end. So thanks. Well, you're welcome. I hope you're enjoying a nice cold beer while you're out there on your snapper mowing the lawn. Secondly, I know how much you enjoy snakes on a plane, so here's the latest example, but this one is barely holding on. This occurred today, and this was, last week, on a Qantas-8 heading to Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. And then he sent me a link to a video from one of the local media outlets in Australia, and it had a video there showing the snake, a python, that was kind of holding on for dear life on what looked like the left engine on the Dash 8, the left engine nacelle. From the narration, it sounds like the snake actually survived, but from what I could see, it probably would have been put down due to the injuries sustained. Well, that's enough for me, so I'll leave you to continue your podcast and wish you safe flying and good times. Thanks, Peter, from Australia, the Blue Mountains. And as I said, a couple of you mentioned this. Liz in Washington also had a link to the snake on a plane. She said, "We are enjoying our clear and cold weather here in the Pacific Northwest. All the best to you and your listeners in the new year." Thank you, Liz. I always appreciate your feedback. And also from Peter Doyle. I think he's also in Australia, and he said that he just saw this, quite graphic and upsetting. Humans or animals, no one should have to suffer like this. And again, it regards the snake on that Qantas Dash 8 flight from Australia to Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. And yeah, sadly, the python didn't make it shortly after they landed in Papua New Guinea. It passed on. So that's kind of sad, but oh well, that's life, I guess. More feedback, this time from my friend Yong Lim Fu. You remember him. He's in Singapore, and he's keeping us apprised of his progress in his journey to become a commercial airline pilot. And he writes in, "May I know where you get your inspirations for the podcast from?" And anyway, I've just received my private pilot license. So congratulations. That's awesome. And so that's just like the first step in your career in aviation. So Yong Lim Fu, congratulations on achieving your private pilot license. And the question regarding where I get my inspirations from, I get my inspiration from you, the listeners, and sending all your feedback and knowing that there are people out there, a lot of people. Now, I know a lot of you listening right now are professional pilots, some of you commercial airline pilots, corporate pilots, missionary pilots, private pilots, but I know also that many of you listening are not pilots at all. And my inspiration is I want to try to open up this world of flying, especially commercial airline flying, to everyone so that you, at least if you have a question about something, you have somebody out there who has been doing it for a while that can answer that question and, relieve some of the mystery involved in this world of aviation. So that's my inspiration, you folks that are listening to this. Also received some feedback from Tim. And I don't remember. Oh, Saratoga Springs, New York. He says, this is Tim from Sarasota Springs. About a 25-minute ride to your occasional leg with Acme into Albany International Airport. I'm 27 years old, and I'm riding because I've had a lifelong passion for all that flies since I was very young, much like yourself. Only recently, however, I began working towards a light sport certificate and have been bitten even harder by the bug, I guess you could say. Anyway, my dream is eventually to fly for a living, and I have a few questions about random aspects of the big iron, as one listener put it. I'm a relatively new listener, so all apologies if you've already covered any of these. First, I noticed while flying commercially that there's usually a vibration or a buffet on rotation, which lasts for a few seconds. Do you feel this from the flight deck? Do you know what causes it? Am I imagining things? Yes, Tim, you're imagining things. No, you're not imagining things. And I would imagine that what you are feeling and hearing, especially the vibration, is that, you know, once we lift off and we have a positive rate of climb, the pilot flying calls for the landing gear to be retracted. And then the pilot not flying or the pilot monitoring will activate the landing gear handle and put it to the up position, and then the landing gear is retracted. And now, depending on the airplane, this can be quite a complicated process. But on my airplane, it's pretty simple. The main landing gear door is open, and the hydraulic system powers the actuators to bring the landing gear up into the landing gear bay. And then after it reaches a certain point, then the landing gear doors come up behind it and seal the whole system off. And the same thing happens with the nose wheel. On my airplane, the doors are mechanically connected to the landing gear. So the hydraulic system retracts the nose landing gear into the nose wheel landing gear bay, and the doors are mechanically connected to that system, so they come up. And you'll have to imagine as you're taking off that you're going at a pretty good rate of speed, and those tires are spinning very, very rapidly. And depending on the airplane and the system, the wheels need to stop spinning because they'll spin on for quite some time. Some airplanes have what we call snubbers, which when the landing gear is retracted, the spinning wheel comes up against them, and then just the friction of the snubber will cause the wheels to kind of stop spinning. And sometimes that causes a little bit of vibration. Other airplanes have systems where the braking system is activated to stop the wheels from spinning. So I would imagine, especially if you're up near the front of the aircraft, that what you're feeling, that vibration, is most likely the spinning tires coming, all that energy kind of being dissipated and coming to a stop. Okay, secondly, as I understand it, you reference knots indicated airspeed, KIAS, at lower altitudes, but at higher flight levels, you begin to reference the Mach meter. I've read that it has to do with the compressibility of air, but don't exactly understand why the indicated airspeed reads slower than you're actually traveling. Just the other day, I was reading a Stahl Mach Buffett speed chart for your former love, the Boeing 727. He says, geeky, I know. And the max speed at sea level was something like 550 knots indicated at sea level and only 280 or so at flight level 350. Also, at what threshold do you begin to reference the Mach meter instead? And yeah, it does have something to do with the compressibility of air, and the ratio, Mach is just the percentage of the speed of sound. So Mach 1 would be the actual speed of sound at that particular altitude and that particular temperature. And so the higher you go, the lower the indicated airspeed becomes to achieve the speed of sound. And so when we're traveling at Mach point, let's say 7.6, a normal cruise speed for the airplane I fly, that means that I'm traveling, or we are traveling, approximately 76% of the speed of sound. And again, at lower altitudes, the indicated airspeed is what's critical, because the air is denser and the speed of sound at the lower altitudes is so much higher. So you really don't consider exceeding or approaching the speed of sound at the lower altitudes. At the higher altitudes, though, you have to start thinking about it. So the transition between indicated airspeed and Mach depends on the aircraft and the climb speed schedule. Now, most of the airliners I've flown, it's somewhere around, it's in the upper 20s to low 30s, approximately 27,000 to 29,000 feet. And if you're an airplane that has a slower climb indicated airspeed, then it would be a lower flight level for the transition. If you're flying an airplane that has a higher climb speed and a higher Mach, then, of course, the transition would occur in the 30 to 32,000, 33,000 range. But somewhere there in the upper 20s to low 30s is where that transition occurs between referencing everything in indicated airspeed and Mach. And the next question that Tim has is it an ACME, McDonnell Douglas, or an FAA policy that you do so at that point? And it really has nothing to do with with policies or regulations. It's more to do with physics and aerodynamics. VMO and MMO. VMO being the velocity, maximum structural operating speed indicated, and Mach MO for the maximum Mach operating speed. And so aircraft have two upper speed limits. VMO is limited by indicated airspeed. MMO is limited by Mach number. The VMO is has to do with the structural consideration, the amount of dynamic pressure that the aircraft can tolerate. And the Mach limiting number is due to aerodynamic characteristics and control of the aircraft. So he goes on, additionally, how close to the high-speed buffet do you tend to fly? Okay, well, try to stay out of the high-speed buffet as much as we can, and it depends on the conditions. If you're in turbulent air, you want to have a greater margin between whatever you're operating, whatever speed you're operating, and the high-speed buffet speed. If it's nice, smooth air, then you might want to push the power up and push the speed up. So it's... Again, more to do with the ride conditions and buffet. As you approach the high-speed buffet, you start getting a little bit of a vibration. It's almost like you're experiencing a little bit of light turbulence, but it's not really turbulence. It's something a little bit different. It's one of those things that kind of gets your attention. When you're operating at speeds approaching the high-speed buffet, you also end up increasing your fuel consumption. So you have to understand that if you're flying at a higher Mach speed, let's say you're, well, as he asks, Tim asks in the next question, does that change in speed? Is that because you're behind schedule? Well, you know, you might be running late and you're trying your best to get the passengers to the airport as quickly as you can so they have a better chance of making their connection flights. It could be that air traffic control, because of flow control considerations, the flow of traffic into some of these big airports, they may have you speed up or slow down. And, of course, most commonly, the reason we usually go a little bit higher speed than normal is if it's our last leg of a trip. And one of the pilots, or both, are trying to get back and make sure that they catch their commuting flight home. So that's kind of a joke, but not really. That's actually kind of true. But again, you have to consider that when you're operating the airplane close to that high-speed buffet or max operating speed, you're going to encounter a little bit of a vibration, and you're going to, more importantly, burn a lot more fuel. So you really should have a good reason for doing it. And finally, he says, I read, don't ask where, it was a while back, that either the pilot flying or pilot monitoring was required to don their oxygen mask at all times above a certain flight level, regardless of pressurization, in case of an inadvertent depressurization of the cabin. That seems as though it would be extremely annoying and cumbersome, especially for communicating and during long flights. So I'm questioning the truth of that bit of information. If it's true, what's the threshold? And yes, Tim, it is true. If you're in FAA land, if you're above flight level 410, one pilot has to be wearing a mask, an oxygen mask, at all times. Now, in my airplane, we don't ever get up to that high because the operating ceiling on the MD-80 series is 37, flight level 370. But we do have a bunch of airplanes that can get up into the low 40s. And again, if you're above flight level 410, so 420 and above, one of the pilots has to be on oxygen the whole time. Now, the airplane that I fly, if one of us leaves their operating seat, then the other pilot must don the oxygen mask if we are above flight level 250. So if we're at 27 or 28, 26, whatever, or above, if somebody has to go out and use the restroom, then guess what? The person that is still in the cockpit at the controls must don the oxygen mask the entire time that the other person is out of their seat. So we try to limit the breaks so that one person doesn't have to be, sucking on the hose. Or if we're, lower altitude, then that's not a consideration. So I hope that answers your questions. He says, I have many more questions. He'll write or leave voice feedback at some point in the future. And he continues at the end of his feedback. I'd like to give a tremendous thanks to you, Captain Jeff. I think I speak for all new pilots and non-flying listeners out there, that you are the friend in the industry that we all wanted but may never have had. Thanks. That's kind of why I do this. You're how I get my flying fix when I'm not physically up there. Also, next time you're laying over in Albany or Troy, New York, although this may sound silly, you'll just have to trust me, a mug full of half oatmeal stout, half raspberry ale from Brown's Brew Pub in Troy is absolutely sublime. If you're more into German-style beer, Wolf's Beer Garden is off the charts, also in Troy. Give one or both a try when time permits, and email me if you'd like company. Best wishes to you and the family. Keep up the good work, and you've got a listener for life. All right. Well, thanks, Tim, he says at the end. Insert aviation salutation here. that's the easy way out. Well, thanks, Tim Light. I'll do that. If I'm up in Albany / Troy anytime in the future, you'll have to show me where these places are. And the oatmeal stout and raspberry ale from Brown's sounds absolutely delicious. So thanks again for your feedback. Keep it coming in, sir. And finally, I think this is my last bit of feedback. And it's about time because we're over the hour point. Just received this today or yesterday. Actually, Tim, the one that I just read, I received that feedback just minutes before I pushed the record button. And let's see, this one I got yesterday from Lennart Lundvik. And he says, hello, Captain Jeff. I'm a huge fan from Falun, Sweden, that discovered your podcast like a month ago and have continuously listened to you while I drive a forklift in a warehouse. I'm 29 years old and have a Catholic background because I was raised up in South America. I got my private pilot's license in September last year. Now I'm studying ATPL theory at Lund University in southern Sweden and working towards a career in aviation as an airline pilot. The future seems bright as I see it, no matter what people tell me. I think you're right, Lennart. Did I say that right? Yes, Lennart. I have a wife, and no, I currently have 53 logged flight hours, and it is very little flight experience, as you can tell, even though I listen to many informative podcasts in aviation like yours and learn new stuff from time to time. I also use Microsoft Flight Simulator with yoke, throttle, quadrant, and rudder pedals and try to make flights as realistic as possible using actual weather conditions, etc. I have a wife and one son, 5 years old, and I try to be as safe as I can in my flying because of them. That's good. And now a little bit of feedback. Number one, I love the long podcasts you make. I appreciate it when you talk about your personal life. It feels like I know you like a good friend while listening to your episodes, and it gives us a glimpse of your emotions and life situation at the time, and I really appreciate it. Well, thanks, Lennart. And you know what? That's, I think, the cool thing about listening to podcasts as opposed to listening to a radio show or whatever. And I agree with you. I listen to a bunch of podcasts, and the people that I listen to, I feel like are my friends, even if I don't know them or never met them. Although I do have a lot of people in the podcasting world that I do know and have met. And you know what? To each one, the people that you hear on the podcast are like, that's the way they are in real life. So I think podcasting, one of the appeals of podcasting is that it's real. And I'm a real person. I mean, what you hear on this podcast, it's me. And so I'm glad you appreciate it, and I appreciate you appreciating it. Okay, number two. I like when you cover accidents, incidents in aviation, especially when you use real in-cockpit audio with ATC communications. And unfortunately, I didn't have any of that on this episode. I plan on doing that whenever I can. He says, I would like to hear more of that kind of episode. And I agree with you. I think that it makes for a more interesting episode, and I enjoy it too. Number three, I would like to hear more from European pilots' perspectives. Maybe if you can interview a European airline pilot, and he can tell how the industry is developing over here and what are the changes to come, like if I'm going to get hired someday. And boy, you know what? It was just the last podcast that I read some feedback from Sebastian, and he is a professional airline pilot in Germany. And he even suggested that I have him on as a co-host sometime, and I'm going to have to do that. So you must be, Sebastian must have paid you some money to send this feedback. No. Hey, Sebastian, if you're listening, really, we'll do this sometime. I think that there is a need out there for folks to hear the perspective of an airline pilot from your part of the world. And if you're listening from Asia or Australia and you want to get involved with this as well, just send me an email and then we'll have some international episodes. And number four, I read on the news that Ryanair makes passengers pay an extra charge for the obligatory screening process in some airports. That sounds crazy to me. Here's the link to the article. And so I clicked on the link, and this has to do with an airport in Latvia. And apparently, Riga International Airport was the security apparatus was being financed by the state budget. Which means that all the services were paid for by taxpayers in Latvia, much like here in the United States. The U.S. government, TSA, is paid for by the citizens of the United States, whether they fly or not. But apparently, the Latvian government decided, you know what? There are a lot of people that never fly and shouldn't have to be taxed to pay for the security for people that do. So they decided to shift the burden for paying for security at Riga International Airport to the airlines. So the airlines, in turn, decided to add the cost of screening into the price of the ticket, which ends up being about 6.5 euros per ticket. However, Ryanair did not agree to include this charge in its ticket price. So, therefore, the Riga airport will have to collect the charge instead of the airline. So, when you're flying in and out of Latvia on Ryanair, you have to pay for the screening when you're leaving the airport. And in this case, it is 7 euros. So, you're paying an extra half euro to pay for the screening service. And Ryanair is the only one that I could tell from this article that decided not to put the price of the security fee into their ticket price, probably for a competitive reason. So that's what I got from reading the article that you linked to, Lennart. So yeah, I mean, somebody's got to pay for these folks to do the security, and either taxpayer dollars or fees added to your airline ticket, or in the case of Ryanair, right out of your pocket or your credit card to pay for that lovely process of screening. Okay, so finally he says, "Be safe, Captain Jeff. I wish you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and of course tailwinds. Regards, a friend from the cold Scandinavian region, Lennart Lundvik," and I'm probably not pronouncing your name properly, but I'm doing the best I can. Now, I do have a little Scandinavian blood. I don't know if you've listened to all my podcasts, and maybe I've not mentioned it. My last name is Nielsen, N-I-E-L-S-E-N, and Lennart, you probably can assume from the E-N at the end of my name that I'm probably from Denmark, and my dad's side of the family came from Denmark, and my mother's side of the family came from Norway. So I have probably 90% or more of my blood, my DNA, is Scandinavian. So I always appreciate my Scandinavian listeners. So thanks again for your feedback, Lennart, and I'm looking forward to hearing more questions and feedback from you. All right, so let me look through this. Make sure I have covered everything. No, I'm not finished. I almost forgot a very important piece of feedback that was sent to me from First Officer Jeff from American Airlines. And you'll remember that in a previous episode, somebody had a question about crew rest and the fact that they thought that they only saw one pilot come out of the cockpit and basically flew all the way across the Atlantic Ocean on one flight and didn't really do much work in the cockpit. And I thought to myself, you know, I think that you must have misunderstood what was happening. And I appealed to my international pilot listeners and contributors, and of course, First Officer Jeff took me up because I called him out on this, and he sent me this piece of feedback. So thanks, Jeff.
Hello, Captain Jeff. It's First Officer Jeff. Quick response for Daniel and his question about crew rest. No, that is not one pilot coming out of the cockpit for most of the cruise portion of flight sitting in that business class seat. There's always two of us up there. Whether there's three pilots or four pilots, it really doesn't matter. We rotate through that crew rest seat, each taking about a two-hour break, depending on the length of the flight. We basically divide the length of the trip minus the takeoff and landing portions into three or four parts, depending on the number of crew members, and we all take a break. So it's not just one guy. There's always two qualified pilots in the cockpit for any of those long-haul or super long-haul flights, whether you're going to Europe or Asia, it doesn't matter. And so just to calm your fears, there's not one guy back there loafing and making the other guy do all the work. Thanks for the podcast. Thanks for the good work. And hope to hear more soon. God bless.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for your feedback, as always. And let's see here. I'm looking through here. Now I think I covered everything. So let's do the closing script for the show. Remember that you too can send feedback. And if you have any questions about anything or something you want to get off your chest, send it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. That's feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. And you know what? I don't care if you send in email feedback or voice feedback. If you're not comfortable with doing that, that's okay with me. So if you do want to send voice feedback, the preferable method is to do as Jeff did, that last piece of feedback. You use your smartphone or your computer to record an MP3 and then send it to me in that email address. Or you could go to my website, Airline Pilot Guy, and click on the Send Me a Voicemail tab. And finally, you can use my voice feedback line. That's area code 304-99-PILOT. That's area code 304-997-4568. And let's see, on Facebook, you can find my Facebook page, Airline Pilot Guy. That's facebook.com. Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. On Twitter, I'm also Airline Pilot Guy. And my website, airlinepilotguy.com. Also, many of you listen to me on Stitcher Radio. You can get that on your iPhone, your iPad, your Android phone, many car systems, the Sync systems and that kind of thing have the Stitcher Smart Radio app on them. And if you want to download that for your phone or device, head over to stitcher.com/airlinepilot or your app store. Remember, Stitcher Smart Radio is the smarter way to listen to radio. And finally, until next time, wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.